by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, economics, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on eminent domain, the Kello case, when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said that? What if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law. Here's a law school professor, the teacher who teaches lawyers at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States. And he can do that without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he goes on to say it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, the other day, the Supreme Court gave a decision called the Kello case, K-E-L-O, versus City of New London, Connecticut. And I'll bet I've seen 15 or 20 articles come through across my desk here commenting about that Kello decision. It's actually an eminent domain case. A lot of literature has been amassed in the legal literature about eminent domain. As we progress along in this lesson, we'll take a look at a couple of three of those types of cases, and I'll show you what takings are and what eminent domain is. But the thing that I was surprised about is that there's not a single article, not a single commentary in favor of the Supreme Court's decision in the Kello case. Every one of them is negative. Now, that's kind of unusual because ordinarily, you know, some law school professor somewhere or somebody somewhere comes along and says, well, we think that that decision is probably pretty correct. Maybe it's not as bad as we thought it was. So I thought I would take up the Supreme Court's side of the case. The case was divided narrowly, 5-4. That was kind of unusual given the from what I've seen here anyway, given the amount of precedent setting, it didn't seem like to me that it was that difficult a case to decide, and it surprised me that the court divided 5-4. I would have thought that the case should have been decided 9-0. 9-0 in favor of the city of New London. That would have been my prediction. Not that the court ruled incorrectly, but that the court ruled incorrectly, or ruled correctly, rather, by such a narrow margin. That was the surprise to me in the case. It's kind of like the story I told you about the polygamy case out in Utah called Reynolds versus U.S., and the court came back 7-0 in favor of convicting Reynolds for polygamy, and every commentator to this day says, well, it was purely religiously motivated against the Mormons, and it was a bad decision, and it was really a poor conclusion. And I took a look at the case and I said, no, I thought the Supreme Court ruled exactly correct in that case. I thought it was a perfect decision, and the case came down 7-0, and you just can't beat that, you know, when all of the justices are in agreement. You can't beat that. When there's disagreement, now that leaves some room for controversy, and I thought that's why we ought to take up this eminent domain Kello case. Let me show you a couple of the negative comments, or the comments against the Supreme Court, depending upon what your thinking is, as to whether the court ruled correctly or incorrectly. So I wanted to start off by saying I think they ruled correctly, and I'm the only guy in America that believes that. Well, I should take that back. There's 5 justices on the Supreme Court and George Gordon, so there's 6 people in America that think that they ruled correctly. Everybody else thinks that they screwed up. So here's a commentary by Nicole Sherrick, and dated Tuesday, July 5th, 2005, so it's a fairly recent commentary. Less than 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that gives local governments unlimited power, I'm going to underline this word, unlimited power to take homes and businesses and give the land to private developers for their own private profit. In Kello versus City of New London, the court allowed the City of New London, Connecticut, to take the homes of Suzette Kello and several other city residents and give their land to a private company to build a commercial center, even though the federal constitution only allows government to condemn property for public use. Now that's the first paragraph there. So let me make a couple of comments here on Nicole Sherrick's first observation. She says it gives local governments unlimited power. I don't think that's true. And I think that the court, in the majority opinion, said that the property has to be taken for public use and that there have to be hearings, notice an opportunity to defend, and an opportunity for the persons whose property is being taken to come in and make a defense. So I don't think it's unlimited. Unlimited means that we're going to take your property and we don't even need to pay you for it. Now, they said there's got to be just compensation, which is what the Constitution allows for. There's got to be notice and opportunity to defend, and there has to be a legitimate public use for the property. The key phrase here is, what is a public use? What is a public use? Is the taking of the property for the purposes of building a freeway a public use? If we were going to build docks, forts, arsenals, and shipyards, would that be a public use? If we were going to build schools and hospitals, would that be a public use? And I think almost everybody would agree that, yes, those are public uses. Okay, let's stretch it out a little bit further and say, well, what if we're going to condemn a stretch of property that is blighted, kind of like the story of Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles back in the 1950s. One of the first tests of eminent domain for urban renewal was Chavez Ravine. 300 Hispanic families lived in this community that today houses the Dodgers stadium or Dodgers baseball team. And they came in there and they said, well, we're gonna pay you people for this property, and we're gonna ship you people out of here and give you nice new homes and this nice new relocation center over here. And nobody that I've ever heard of or talked to has ever condemned the taking of those 300 families home to build Dodger Stadium. Of course, at that time, it was for urban renewal. The urban renewal deal didn't go through, and so the stadium did go through. But the point I'm making is, well, what is a public use? Everybody seems to be agreed that we can take that property to build a baseball stadium. We can take that property to build new housing. You know, if we want to build a Cabrini Green in Chicago, I guess we could condemn the property of a bunch of shanties and then build these giant high-rise urban redevelopment projects and then blow them up and knock them to the ground at taxpayer expense. That seems to be a public use. No, never heard of anybody complaining about that. She goes on to say, none of the homes taken by the city were an eyesore or in severe disrepair. They were condemned simply because they were located in an area where the city wanted to see more development. City officials reasoned that more development would generate more tax revenue for the city. All right, now is that a legitimate public use? Everybody says, no, that's not a legitimate public use. The taking of the property, this commentator, Nicole Sherrick, says that none of the homes were taken by the city because they were in eyesore or in severe disrepair. Well, let's suppose, Nicole, that they were in severe disrepair or that they were an eyesore. Let me ask you, first of all, who determines whether or not a house is an eyesore? And who determines whether or not this property is in severe disrepair? Let's take a look here at the city's power of eminent domain. Let's suppose, Nicole, that you're driving a brand new Lexus right off the showroom floor. And I'm driving a 1978 Chevy pickup, and it's a real eyesore. It's all rusted out. The windshield's got two or three cracks in it. The right door doesn't work, and there's no window glass in the left door at all. The paint is peeling off of it, and it's just really a terrible eyesore. Would you say, then, that the government has a right to take my ugly pickup, but not your new Lexus? Where did we get the idea the government has the power to take anybody's property for any cause or reason? You know, where does this concept come from, anyway? Well, I'll show you a little later that it came from the Bible. An eminent domain has an origin, and it comes from the Scripture, and there's a methodology for taking property. And we've adopted that biblical principle into our federal constitution. It's in the Fifth Amendment, and might as well read it to you right now. It's only a few words. In fact, I can count the words. It's that short. Fifth Amendment, it's just the last clause where it says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. We could go up one clause further, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property. And certainly Mrs. Keller was deprived of her property. Property, that's her house. Why do we want to take her house? And the city came along and said, well, because we want to build hotels and resorts and we want to make a more viable commercial piece of property here that pays more taxes. Mrs. Kello probably pays $1,000 or $2,000 a year in taxes. And if we take her house, along with 15 other people's houses, and we build a hotel, this hotel is going to pay, maybe $500,000 a year. I mean, these 16 homeowners, you think about it, if they're paying property tax on a residential piece of property, they're probably paying a couple thousand bucks a year. So the city's making $50,000 a year in tax revenue off of these 16 houses, probably top dollar. I could be wrong. You know, I've seen houses that are being taxed $1,000 a month. But, you know, if we were to put a new Holiday in there, you know, or a Holiday Inn Express or something, why, you probably would pay $500,000 a year in taxes. In other words, 10 times the tax revenue. Is that a legitimate public use of the property? To take your property, redevelop it into something else, and then from that redevelopment generate more tax revenue. Well, it's less tax revenue for the rest of the community to pay, so it's a tax benefit to every other member of the city of New London, Connecticut. If the city is going to spend $1 million a year and 50,000 of it's coming from Kello and her neighbors, And we're going to build a new Holiday Inn, and the Holiday Inn is going to pay $500,000 in taxes. Well, that would be half the city's budget. Then it would reduce everybody else's taxes by half using that theory, using that line of reasoning. Isn't reducing the tax burden on all of the other residents of New London by 50% or 20% or 2% or 1% or 0.1% a public purpose? Now, if that's a public purpose, then notice how many words are used here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 words. Nor shall private property, Mrs. Kellow's private property, be taken for public use without just compensation. So if we're going to take her property, then we have to give her just compensation. I think the key is just compensation. Did Mrs. Kellow get paid just compensation? I'll bet you she didn't get paid just compensation. I'm going to show you that. I think Mrs. Kellow took it in the shorts. I think Mrs. Kellow was getting screwed out of her just compensation, and the city got away with it. They got away with it because Mrs. Kellow, when she took her case to the Supreme Court, said, "They're not taking my property for public purpose." And I think that the real issue to be argued there is, did Mrs. Kellow get paid just compensation for her property? Irrespective of whether or not it's being taken for a public purpose or not. 12 words. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, in those 12 words, there is nothing, to my mind, that I can see in those 12 words that would delineate what is and what is not a public use. That's a decision to be made at the local level at the time. The determination as to whether or not this use of that property is public use or public domain is a factual decision to be decided at the time. And the founding fathers, when they wrote it into the Constitution, put in 12 words and they said, nor shall this property be taken for public use without just compensation. They didn't say that it has to be taken for docks, forts, arsenals, shipyards, hospitals, schools, or freeways. They didn't say what the public use was. They said, if you're going to take it for public use, then you got to give her just compensation, fair price. What is a fair price? What is a fair price for Mrs. Kellow's property? Now, I'll bet you that Mrs. Kellow's property is valued based upon taxes. I'll bet you that they've got a tax scheme there. If it's anything like ours, then they come along with what they call a mill levy. And they said, well, Mrs. Kellow's house is worth $200,000, but for tax purposes, it's worth $50,000. And I'll bet you when they come along, they say, well, we're going to give you $50,000 because that's what we're taxing it at. But if she puts it out on the market, I bet you she could get $200,000. I mean, the average price of a house in this country today is $210,000. So I find it hard to believe that her house is worth less than $210,000, which is the median price. Did she get paid $210,000? But listen, if she did get paid $210,000, she got screwed. In fact, she got screwed, blued, and tattooed. And that's assuming that they gave her the full retail residential value of the house. She got screwed by at least five times. Five times. And I'm going to show you that. So that in the future, if this ever happens to you, that you don't waste your time going in there and arguing the losing side of the case. Go in there and argue the winning side of the case. It doesn't mean you're going to get paid, or that you're going to get paid everything that you got coming to you, but at least you'll be arguing the right issue. Let's go on to the next paragraph. Nicole Sherrick goes on to say that city officials, well, she says, none of the homes taken by the city were an eyesore or in severe disrepair. I wanted to ask the question, who makes the decision as to whether or not they're in severe disrepair or an eyesore? Who makes that decision? It certainly isn't determined in the Fifth Amendment. And I would go on to say that even if it was an eyesore or in severe disrepair, as was the case in Chavez Ravine, I mean, everybody was agreed that these houses are ugly. These houses are in disrepair. These people are poor, and we need to take their property away from them and remove these people from this poverty and put them in a Cabrini Green in a high-rise down the street that's got running water. I mean, I guess some of these houses didn't have running water. And I'm sitting here saying, well, there wasn't anybody in that Chavez Ravine that wanted to sell their property. They were forced to sell it at gunpoint. Some of those people were physically removed by government agents. The police came in there and picked them up and physically drug them out of their houses while they were kicking and screaming. And their houses were ugly. And I'm sitting here asking the question, what in the hell business is it of government to come along and say, your house is ugly, so we're going to throw you out of it. And we're going to give you just compensation. Everybody in Chavez Ravine, so far as I know, so far as the record shows, was given just compensation for their houses. Everybody got paid what the house was worth. My question is, who in hell gave the government the power to come in here and make a determination that your house is an eyesore and that it needs to be torn down and that I'm the guy to come along and make that determination for you? She goes on to say, city officials invoke the power of eminent domain, a legal term meaning the government's authority to force people to sell their homes for a piece, or a price rather, that the government decides is fair. That's not true, Nicole. The government doesn't decide that. A jury decides that. And you're entitled to a jury trial on the question of what is and what is not just compensation. In all matters over $20, and I presume that Mrs. Kello's house was worth $20, and if she'd wanted to, she was entitled to a jury trial, and the members of the community could have listened to her notice and opportunity to defend. And she could have walked in and said, my property is worth more than $210,000, and here's why. Here's why my property is worth at least $1.5 million, and that's for openers. I wouldn't sell that for less than $1.5 million, and it's worth $1.5 million to these developers over here. And if it was on the market, they would pay $1.5 million and love it. And I say it's worth more than that. But I'm entitled to at least what the market value is of the commercial property that they're going to turn it into. That would have been my argument. So, it isn't what the government decides is fair. Now, of course, the government comes in and offers you $50,000 for this property because that's what it's being taxed at. And if you don't know how to defend, this is why I teach a school on courtroom strategy and procedure. You know, just because somebody comes along and makes these claims doesn't mean that you have to accept it. It means that you're entitled to notice an opportunity to defend. Now, if you're ignorant and you can't defend and you have to go to an attorney who's probably going to be working for the city, which is like inviting a spy into your side of the, or into your camp or into your side of the argument, well, then that's your problem in life, not mine. You're just as entitled to go out there and educate yourself as I am. Somebody said the other day that this is going to impact upon the poor more than on the rich, more than likely. But aren't the poor just as entitled to go out and educate themselves as are the rich? No, I didn't go to college. I educated myself. Henry Ford didn't go to college. He educated himself. Thomas Edison had a third grade education. He didn't seem to be lacking in his ability to invent or his ability to make money. You know, just because somebody doesn't have an education doesn't make them dumb, doesn't make them stupid, doesn't make them incapable of educating themselves. Education requires work. It requires diligence. If people are lazy and they don't want to work and they don't want to be diligent, that's their choice in life. I don't make ignorance. Paragraph 4, she goes on to say, what happened to Ms. Kello and her neighbors, or what happened, rather, to Ms. Kello and her neighbors in Connecticut is currently happening across the country. Both local and state governments are increasingly using the power of eminent domain to create opportunities for private developers, oftentimes with complete disregard for the concerns of homeowners and small business owners. From Ohio to California, governments have decided that a private developer, not a homeowner, can create the best use of the property. Governments then use the power of eminent domain to complete the transfer of property from one private landowner to another, essentially stripping homeowners of any legal right to keep their property and grafting the new owner, or granting rather, the new owner a giant financial windfall. I'm going to take exception here. I don't think Mrs. Kellogg was a homeowner. Yeah, let me repeat that. I don't believe that Mrs. Kellogg owned that piece of property. I think that at best she could describe herself as an equitable interest holder in due course. Equitable interest holder in due course of a piece of property that was owned by the city of New London, Connecticut. And it's evidenced by the fact that she was paying a property tax on that property. If she had owned that property, we would have a much different case before us. But she had an equitable interest in somebody else's property, and she called herself a homeowner. It's normal. Most of you people out there listening to me right now call yourselves homeowners. Let me ask you this. Are you paying on a mortgage? Well, doesn't the bank own the house? And don't you have an equitable interest in the bank's house based upon a contract for deed to be delivered at some future date premised upon your specific performance over time? Now somebody says, but I specifically performed over time and now I've got the deed. Excuse me, boys and girls, but aren't you paying a property tax? And aren't you paying the property tax on this piece of property that you hold the deed to? And isn't the property tax being paid to compensate the bondholders who actually have a lien on the property pending your specific performance on the school bonds that you voted in? Or the limited improvement district, the sewers and gutters, the street lights, and all of the rest of the benefits that you receive by pledging your property as collateral for those benefits. Isn't that really where reality is located? So I would take exception to this paragraph. What happened to Ms. Kellogg and her neighbors in Connecticut is currently happening across the country. That's true. It's happening to people all across the country. People who are equitable interest holders in due course. I haven't heard this happening to property owners. Property owners. In a 5-4 decision, the court held that cities across America can take private property from one person and give it to another. Private property. I don't think Mrs. Kellogg owned any private property there. Now, I don't know that that wasn't private property, and it may have been. And it may have been. But, you know, I've been in this legal business for 21 years, and I haven't seen any private property. You know, not since 1933, when we came up with this House Joint Resolution 192. Do you remember that? House Joint HJR 192. Not since we imposed the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, not since we Americans converted from private property, that is, thou shalt not steal, to from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. Once we adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in place of the 10 commandments, we made a pretty profound political and economic change in our lifestyle. This is back in 1933, June 5th, 1933 to be exact. Now, I don't make these laws. I don't make these rules and regulations. And I want to say that the Supreme Court of the United States doesn't make these rules. They don't make these regulations either. And the question posed to them was, is this a taking without just compensation? And the court came back and said, no, sir, this is not a taking without just compensation. That the city of New London taking Mrs. Kellogg's property is not a violation of the Fifth Amendment. That's all they said, was it doesn't violate the Fifth Amendment. Now, if you were to ask the question, is it right? Should government have that power? Should the power of eminent domain have been used against Mrs. Kellogg in this case and so on down the line? I think the answer would be a resounding no, but I don't think in this particular case that Mrs. Kellogg has been wronged either by the Supreme Court or the Fifth Amendment. I think Ms. Skello was wronged by House Joint Resolution 192. I think that she was wronged by her public school system. I think that she's been wronged by the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. But I think Ms. Skello is probably the proximate cause of her own injury in this case. And I'm going to show you why as we progress. So, in a 5-4 decision, the court held that cities across America can take private property. And I don't believe that for a minute. I do not believe that the court has authorized that cities can take private property from one person and give it to another in the name of economic development. I don't believe that. Now, I know that's the common language that's being used. I think there's a big difference here, and I'm going to explain that one while I'm right here on that subject. Let me put a little arrow right here. There's a big difference between calling something unconstitutional and calling it constitutional. Now, it's been referred to me many times. People will say that the income tax is unconstitutional. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled numerous times that the income tax is not unconstitutional. They never said that it was constitutional. They said it's not unconstitutional. The taking of Mrs. Kello's property over here, if it was in fact private property, is decidedly unconstitutional. The taking of Mrs. Kello's equitable interest property is not unconstitutional. Big difference here, boys and girls, between private property and equitable interest property. All right, let's take a break right here. Let me give you a couple of reminders that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate, and they are correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, or they may be sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review per se. Remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, the views and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're taking a look here at commentary. Is Your Home Next by Nicole Sherrick. Good article. I agree with Ms. Sherrick. I guess it's Ms. Politically, I think that she's correct. Legally, I think that she's out to lunch. As a matter of law, I know she's out to lunch. And that's why I raised the question. Who in the hell gave government the option to determine that your house is an eyesore anyway? Why would you say, I used this example, I said, why would you say that if Miss Sherrick here was driving a brand new Lexus, that that's all right, but if I'm driving a beat out old Chevy pickup over here, mine ought to be condemned and taken off the highway? We do that today. We have laws, for instance, in our state here, you have to take your car in every year and have it inspected. I mean, you can take it in to whoever you want to have it inspected, but you can't register it until it's got this inspection sticker. So the inspector looks at it and he says, well, look at this. You got a window here that doesn't work. Well, that's got to be repaired. Now, I'm sure that Miss Sherrick's window in her brand new Lexus probably works by remote control and electronic motors, but mine, the handle's off of the window, the manual window machine over here, and I have to roll mine up manually by twisting the crank, and the crank is gone, and now my car is going to be condemned. I can't register my car. Why not? This is what happened in Chavez Ravine. I think that it's the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto that's our real problem over here, not the Supreme Court. And I think the adoption of communism was a mistake. And Ms. Kello is the victim of the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto here. That's my opinion, not a misapplication of the Fifth Amendment. I think I can show you that as we progress along. Now, but if you think about it, nearly every imaginable project that a city could undertake could be plausibly described as economic development. A city can designate a neighborhood as a development area, take the homes and land, and hand that land over to a private developer. In a few years, a fancy hotel, a new business park, even a manufacturing plant could be sitting where your home used to be, based on the court's extreme theory. All right, on the court's extreme theory. I'm going to underline that. Well, it works the other way, too. Let's suppose that there's a Holiday Inn down here, and Walmart comes along and says, well, how much tax is Holiday Inn paying? And the city of New London says, well, they're paying $500,000 a year in taxes for their Holiday Inn hotel overlooking the bay. And then Walmart comes along and says, well, gee, let's condemn that Holiday Inn. And let's tear that piece of trash down because it's an ugly eyesore. Who determines whether the Holiday Inn is an ugly eyesore? Well, the executives of Walmart. Because we're going to build a big gray box store here and we're going to pay you $1 million a year in taxes. I mean, you know, you could take to, you know, if you want to take this out to an extreme theory, isn't commerce worth a lot more than residential? Why don't we tear all the houses in New London, Connecticut down, throw all the damn people out of the city, and just build an industrial complex there? You know, like General Motors did in Detroit years back. They came along and said, hey, we want to build an industrial plant. So let's just condemn a square mile over here, tear that down, throw all of these ugly Mexicans and blacks out of here because their houses are ugly eyesores over here. Anyway, let's build this beautiful General Motors industrial complex that's going to pay the city of Detroit a lot more tax money. I mean, in theory, I mean, that's what we could do, couldn't we? Well, we can do that under the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We couldn't do that when we practiced the 10 commandments. You know, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. That's a wild new concept for most of you because we haven't practiced the 10 commandments in this country for about 100 years now. So for most people that are involved with separation of church and state, and they want to take religion out of the public schools and religion out of public politics. I mean, after all, we don't want thou shalt not steal to come into this event called the Kello decision now, do we? I mean, for this private developer to come in here and steal Mrs. Kello's property, we don't want to call that a theft. We want to take this in purely on a secular theory of law. We don't want to bring this in here onto a theory of law that, my God, these people are stealing this lady's property. You know, if we brought this in under the theory of the common law, we'd have a theft going on here. Theft. That's why you have to pay just compensation to prevent the theft, because there's a law that says thou shalt not steal. We don't practice thou shalt not steal. We practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. And I'm sure that Mrs. Keller is going to be compensated according to her need. And who's going to decide what her need is? Well, I guess some public agency. They decided, well, what this is what your public need is, lady. Some cases of economic development are truly absurd. The city of Las Vegas recently condemned a clean, privately owned shopping center to build a parking lot for the Fremont Street Experience. Okay, I just mentioned that to you. What's wrong with the city coming along and taking a commercial piece of property and converting it into a more advantageous piece of commercial property? Nothing. Nothing. We came to that conclusion back in the 1930s under House Joint Resolution 192. We came up to the conclusion that we don't need just weights and balances. What we need is commercial property. What we need is commerce. Now, if you want to bring things under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8, government has no limitations on commerce, boys and girls, and Miss Kello's property is commercial. And I think that if it's going to be a commerce issue, that Miss Kello should be paid the commercial value of the property, not the residential value. And that's why I'm contending that she's not being paid just compensation. Think about it. Let's suppose that Ms. Kello's property is being taken, and she's going to be paid residential rates for the property, and let's say that that's about $200,000, the median price for a house. And so the 16 people are going to lose their houses. The minute that this is redeveloped, rezoned commercial, it'll be worth five times that without her house on that property. Just the land alone will be worth five times what Ms. Kello is going to be paid for that property. And the people that are across the street from Ms. Kello, their property is going to be rezoned commercial. And the minute that that happens, the 16 people whose property was condemned residential get paid residential rates, and the 16 people across the street get their property rezoned to commercial, and their property is suddenly worth five times more than it was before. So here's 32 people on two sides of a street. On the north side of the street, we're going to condemn that property and make it commercial. The people on the south side of the street, their property is also zoned commercial. I mean, I don't know where you do you take commercial out, on the center line of the street, or is it in the next alley over on the south side? My experience has always been it's on the next alley over on the south side. And so they fall into a windfall. Their property now is worth five times what Ms. Kello got paid for her property over here. And that's why I say I don't think Kello's getting paid just compensation. But then, of course, she didn't argue just compensation. She went in and argued that the property couldn't be taken because it's not for public use. And the court came back and said, oh, yeah, that's a public use. The court made a decision. The court said, can the city of New London take this property for public use? And the court said, yep, they can. Is this a public use? And they said, yep, it is. The issue as to whether or not Ms. Kello is being paid just compensation never came up in the decision. I don't think she's being paid just compensation. And if Ms. Kello, I mean, if the developer had come in there and bought that property, you know, everybody will sell at some price. Let me just ask you this question. You got a house. Would you want me to come in there and condemn your house and take it away from you and build a Walmart store on your property over here if I paid you every dime that your property is worth as a residence today? Yeah, you might say, well, no, I wouldn't want you to take it. Okay, well, would you sell it to me for double? Well, no, I wouldn't sell it to you. What would you sell it to me for? Triple, quadruple, sextuple. Listen, boys and girls, let's suppose that you got a house, and let's suppose that your house is worth $200,000, and I come along and say, I will give you $1 billion for your house. Will you sell it to me? I'm just out here betting that at some point in time, when the numbers get high enough out there, you'll sell. And that's what the market price is, isn't it? That's what the market price is. It's where the buyer and seller come to an agreement. I've been out here buying and selling for a long time, boys and girls, and I didn't get to buy every piece of property that I wanted. But I bought a lot of them. And I've often noticed that as you keep escalating the offer, It makes reluctant sellers more amenable to selling. I think Ms. Keller would have sold that property at some price. I don't know what her price was, but at some price she would have sold that property. Now, some cases of economic development are truly absurd. The city of Las Vegas recently condemned a clean, privately owned shopping center. Clean, privately owned shopping center. Okay, what if it was a dirty, publicly owned shopping center? Would that have made it a difference? If it was dirty. If there was grass growing up in the cracks. I guess, to most people's mind, if it's dirty property, it's all right to condemn it, but if it's clean property, it isn't right to condemn it. Oh, okay. I follow your line of reasoning. If you got a bunch of Hispanics that are living in ugly eyesore property in Chavez Ravine, it's all right to take their property away from them, but if it's clean, neat property in Bel Air, you can't. Oh, I think that's flawed reasoning. In my view. And I think that the concept that a man's house is his castle, which is the old common law rule, remember that old, a man's house is his castle? I think that was a better form, a better system of law than what we've replaced it with. Today, a man's house is not his castle. It's his commerce. A man's house today is his commerce. And that commercial property, that commerce, can be seized and taken for a higher, better commercial use under the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8. I think that's wrong. I think it's a mistake. But, you know, when we're doing a legal analysis over here, I don't make these rules and regulations, and boys and girls, neither does the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court did not enact House Joint Resolution 192. But from time to time, they've been asked to rule on it. And this is one of those cases. Now, HJR 192 didn't come up, I'm sure, in the pleadings in this case. But the underlying theory of law traces back to commerce. Does the government have a right to take this property? And the answer is yes. Why? Well, because it's commercial. This is a commercial venture, boys and girls. The city of New London says that we're going to make more money off of this property. And the city of New London is a business. The city of New London is a governmental entity. It's a business. And they're going to make more money by doing away with these houses over here and replacing it with hotels and shopping. My question is, why should government have that power to start with? They got that power under the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. They did not get that power from the 10 Commandments. Now, boys and girls, you know, I know you all hate God, and you all hate the Ten Commandments, and you all hate the common law, and you worked hard to replace it. Okay, well then, Ms. Kello, this is the results that you get from it. Nicole, this is the result that comes from this system or theory of law as opposed to the old theory of law. See, there was a time in America when we couldn't do this. But, you know, when you change your king, you change your law, and when you change your law, you change your king. We found that in 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you'll remember. All right, now, an Arizona city tried to take a small brake repair shop to give the land to a hardware store instead. And in Merriam, Kansas, city officials condemned a Toyota dealership to transfer the property to a BMW dealer to give the town a more fashionable image. Okay, it's what I just told you. I mean, if the city can take Mrs. Kello's house, the city can take the brake shop, the city can take the hardware store, the city can take whatever the hell they want. But not under the theory of private property, it's under the theory of commerce. I think that there's an error being slipped in here. We're not talking about private property, we're talking about commerce. Commercial property. Ms. Kello doesn't own that property. She doesn't have an allodial tenure title on that piece of real estate. The city of New London owns that piece of real estate. The underlying lien against that property is evidenced by the property tax. Ms. Kello is paying rent to the city of New London. And the city of New London, let's look at the theory this way. Let's suppose that you're renting a house from me. and you're paying me $200 a month rent on this house. And then one day I come to you and I say, well, I'm going to evict you and throw you out of this house. And you say, well, that's not very nice of you, George. That'll put me out on the street and I'll be homeless. And I say, not only that, I'm not even going to give you any compensation. And you say to me, well, why are you going to evict me and throw me out of this house? And I say, well, I'm going to tear this house down and I'm going to build a high-rise apartment house here because I'm going to make more money off of a high-rise apartment house than I'm going to make off of this single-family residence rent to you. And you say to me, well, you know, that just isn't right. I've been renting from you for 20 years. George paid my rent every month, and I'm really a good tenant. And I say, well, Tom, you know, you're really telling the truth there. You've been a wonderful tenant. And I love you like a brother, and there's nothing personal here. It's just commercial. You know, it's just commerce, just money. It's just business. And I can make a lot more money tearing this house down and building an apartment house than I can renting this house to you. And that's what I'm going to do. It's called highest and best use. So it's a real estate term that we use. Highest and best use. Would you say that I don't have a right to evict you from this house? Because you've been paying your rent every month faithfully for 20 years? You don't have any claim on this house. This house isn't yours. It's my property. It's my house. I'll do with it as I please. Now we're talking about private property. If Miss Kello actually owned that house and we're talking about private property, you know, we'd have a much different case here. We're not talking about private property here, boys and girls. We're talking about commercial property. We're not even talking about private property that Miss Kello has a legitimate claim to. She's just paying rent to the city of New London, has for many years, called a property tax. She called herself a property owner. You know, renters do that. They say, this is my home. I can remember I used to rent, and I'd say, well, I live over here at 2204 Jones Road. That's my home. My home. My home. That's my house. People drive around in their cars. This is my car. This is my car. My car. Now, who owns this car? Well, GMAC owns the car, but, you know, you're driving it around. You've got an equitable interest in it. You got a better claim to it than I do, and so you call it my car. Ms. Kello is calling this my house. It wasn't her house. It was the city of New London's house. I think we ought to start asking some hard questions here. How in the hell did the city of New London get hold of Ms. Kello's house to start with? Where did that come in? Where does this equitable interest and allodial tenure and title come into the game? Why have we Americans given up our allodial tenure and title and property rights and thou shalt not steal for an equitable interest in to each according to his ability and from each according to his need and to each according to his ability? Where did we get off on that track? I think that's where we ought to start our investigation. Now, Nicole goes on. I guess I shouldn't call you Nicole. I should call you Miss Sherrick. She says, but even though the Constitution states that property may only be taken for public use and not for a private use at all, the Supreme Court held that these kinds of condemnations are perfectly okay. Well, that's correct. The court said private property can only be taken for public use and not for private use at all. The city of New London owns Miss Kello's house, as evidenced by the property tax that she's paying. She's paying rent on the property. Let's test it this way. Let's see if Miss Kello actually owns the property. Leaving aside the condemnation, what if she didn't pay her property tax this year, next year, and the year after? Wouldn't her house be sold on the courthouse steps to the highest bidder for the taxes due against the house? Now let me ask you this. Who owns that house? If the city of New London can put the house up for sale, then isn't it the city of New London's house? I mean, come on, boys and girls. Let's grow up and get real here. Where did the city get the power to put your house up on the market? Because you didn't pay the taxes, because you didn't pay the rent. You ever think about that? So the Constitution states that private property may only be taken for public use and not for private use at all. Well, Ms. Sherrick, you do err there. There's nothing in the Fifth Amendment over here that says anything about public or private use. It says when property is being taken, let me read this to you again, 12 words, remember these 12 words? Fifth Amendment, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. The real key question here is Ms. Kellogg's house private property? I just demonstrated that to you. It's obviously not private property. If the city can sell it, has anybody ever said, wait a minute, the city cannot take your property and sell it to somebody else and evict you from it because you don't pay your property tax? Have you ever heard such an argument made? I've never heard anybody say that the city can't take your property or the state or anybody else for not paying your taxes. Well, the tax is rent. Now, I can evict you from my house if you don't pay me the rent. We call that private property. There's some misunderstanding as to what property is. You know that? So I think we should probably take a look at the word property. Let me write that down. Number 24, property. Is property the house? Is property the thing? Or is property the right to use the thing? You know, a tenant renting a house has a property right in that rented house. He has the right to use that house while he's paying the rent on it. That's a property right. But that doesn't mean that he owns the house. Doesn't mean that he owns the property. Now, Ms. Kello has a property right in her house, but that doesn't make that property right her property. So she's got a property right in the city of New London's property, the house. And she comes along and says, well, wait a minute. You can't use this house for that kind of use. And the court said, well, yeah, the city of New London can use that house for that kind of a use. Let's try it this way. Let's suppose that you're leasing a house from me and you got a 5-year lease on this house. You've lived in the house now for 2.5 years, and I come along and say, I want to evict you from this house. I want to build an apartment house here. And you say, no, you can't do that because, you see, I've got a property right here. I've got a lease, this piece of paper. I don't own the physical house. I don't own the land that it's sitting on. I don't own the rocks, the mineral, and the earth that's under it. But I do own a property right in that house, and my property right runs for another 2.5 years, and you cannot get me out of this house. You can't throw me out of here without paying. So I've got to buy that lease out. That's what the bottom line is. I've got to buy that lease out. Well, I'm out of time. We'll take it up right here with Nicole Sherrick's commentary, Is Your Home Next? On Eminent Domain, the Kello case, when we come back tomorrow night. All right, I'm about out of time, so I've got to give you a couple of reminders here. And that is that the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. I'm out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.